11 o'clock in New York City. On the Progressive Radio Network, my name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight. How are you doing? Big weekend ahead. The North Pole will be heading down here. The big man himself. My four-year-old, every year, this cracks me up. She breaks out her antlers, and she becomes a reindeer for about a month. So after the first of the year, she'll finally put them down. But when she wakes in the morning, they go on her head. They remain on her head until the end of the day, until she falls asleep in bed, until she rolls over and they fall off. Cutest damn thing in the world. Hey, entrepreneurs, we got a show for you. Anyone in business, anyone who's considering maybe starting their own business, etc., we have really, really insightful advice today from my guest, Michael Dermer. Just a few years ago out of law school, Dermer left a coveted job as a corporate lawyer to pursue the dream of being his own boss. Wouldn't we all like to be our own boss? The bold idea of rewarding Americans for healthy behavior. What is healthy behavior? I'll have to ask Bhavani about that. And in the process, saving the healthcare system, a bundle. We're going to find out a lot about, you know, the detrimental behaviors of entrepreneurs, the culture and environment and landscape you want to set as a precedent for a very small company, for even a larger company, even when you're in a very young, small, organic size of a company growing, because it's tantamount into setting the right tone early on. So if there are any entrepreneurs out there or anyone thinking about that, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, if you want to call in a few minutes, for questions for my guest, Mike Dermer. So, you know, this sounds kind of coincidental that I'm going to be talking about change in life, because it's, you know, kind of the end of the year and people think about change in their life. Kind of like my wife and I, when we were dating, every January she'd say, let's have a State of the Union address. And he used to freak me out before we were engaged. And it was kind of like state of the relationship, and it made sense because, hey, let's take inventory of who we are, what we're doing. This is before I proposed to her, by the way. So I guess you wanted to see where my head was at and, you know, where this thing called love was going. So it kind of makes me think about last 8 months or so. My now 89-year-old mother has gone through a lot of changes in life. And it made me reflect, some of them good, some of them bad, mostly good. But she's a very, very vivacious 89-year-old. You would never think she was probably a day over 70. And that says a lot, because from 70 to 89, 90, a lot of things happen. Big changes, physically, cognitively, etc. So, and I bring this up because I think the world of her. There's two heroes in my life, my father and my mother. Indomitable spirits, huge, compassionate, driven, giving people who have made me the person that I am, and certainly my four siblings. But more so because I want to just share with you that all she's come through in life, and her latest change in life has proven to me that change is never, ever too late. So here she is. She's 89 years old, kind of a rough growing up, Freehold, New Jersey, not too far from New York City, about an hour, 55 miles south. Didn't have a lot, certainly growing up. Got herself through college, became a nurse. She was a high school nurse in Freehold Borough for 30 years, where she was basically sealed her name as an iconic status because everyone knows her as Mrs. Farrell. Mrs. Farrell's the best because she always had time to listen to someone's problems, offer advice, especially with girls, possibly early pregnancy, things of that nature. Just always on the student's side. And why not a better person in a position, a nurse, to do that? And certainly outside the office, she was no different. Very, very caring, compassionate, et cetera. And it almost sounds like I'm giving a, oh my God, what's the term? When someone passes, no, my mother is still with us, please. Knock on wood. But the reason why I bring this up is because lately she had to undergo a major move. So when you're 89 years old and you have to move after living in a place for only 16 years because she went, we moved her out of her big house. She was kind of a little reluctant, but she did it. And I think she's doing great. And her quality of life has really been an uptick. And I really take my hat off to her because she could have said no. And we wouldn't have certainly been able to force her to move. But the reality is she was willing. And I think it's a very, very positive move overall for her life. But change is not easy. I mean, you can ask anyone who's 20 years old, 30 years old, 40, 50, etc., that some people are major, major creatures of habit. Even if they're in a job that they despise, cause them physical pain, anguish, they have to go on medication, you name it, or in a relationship that is just could be physically or mentally abusive. People are deathly afraid of change. We all know that. We know people who are in our lives, friends, coworkers. I'm looking at one right now. No, I'm just kidding. That, you know, change is just very, very difficult. It's hard to embrace. But the alternative is, I guess, a lifetime of sadness. But the options that you have in terms of creating change is incredibly rewarding. I mean, we've heard all these tenets and aphorisms about, you know, change is this, this, and this, but, you know, on the other side, you got to put yourself out there. But the reality is it's scary. But, you know, life can be full of risk, unwanted risk or risks that you choose to take. I chose to take a risk about 6-7 years ago when I was on New York City radio for 20 years and saw the digital medium kind of obviously growing in tenfold manner. And radio in New York City and nationally was being reduced. So I decided after the latest owners had purchased the radio company and sold it and fired everybody that I was going to start a speaking business. And I was very happy and confident and going out and hanging a shingle, which I have. And I'm doing pretty well. Doing not the best financially, but impacting people's lives. The money's going to come. I'm sure of that. But more importantly is my message is getting out there to kids K through 12, college students, organizations, corporations, about overcoming adversity, drugs and alcohol, you name it. So that was my change. And it wasn't a huge leap of faith because I have been speaking for a living for quite some time. And I've been in this area, this industry and being on stages like Madison Square Garden and speaking to people. But it's a whole different beast when you're putting your own personal experiences, your failures, your fears, and your successes and your triumphs out there for audiences. So I'm not minimizing what I did, but I'm also not trying to say what I did was extremely courageous. But nonetheless, it's change. It's reinvention. So going back to my mother, for 89 years of age, that is even, I can't even imagine how much more difficult it is exponentially. So when I think of a woman who has beat cancer twice, when I think of a woman who had to decide to leave her husband, who was an alcoholic with 5 kids, to up and leave, I think of somebody who has incredible determination, who has fears, but realizes that she has to sacrifice those fears for a better life. Worked 2 or 3 jobs. When I was in high school, 7th, 8th grade, high school, you know, she'd come home from her day job as a high school nurse, leave me a few bucks possibly on a refrigerator because there was a great Italian restaurant around the corner for $5. You could have all the pizza, spaghetti, and bread you could consume. And I did. And I finally ended up getting a job there. But nonetheless, she worked her tail off to give us opportunity and instilled a great work ethic and morals, which is something parents everywhere, or for our listeners who are listening anywhere in this world to the Progressive Radio Network, fully need to understand. I'm sure most listeners who listen to this network, people who are intelligent and certainly care about their children, understand the significance of just educating your... Like I tell my kids, I have 3 things I need to do for you as a parent. Keep you safe, love you, and educate you. Those are the 3 things. So those are the three things that she did very, very well. And one of the things that, on a sidebar here, she felt extremely, extremely guilty that she was a carrier of a gene that gave me and my brother Mike, because we're both men, the visual impairment that we have. So she has incredible guilt still. And I'm like, Mom, listen, we have vision. We can see, you know, that's okay. And she would, you know, she had these moments every decade or so. Because she's an Irish woman. You got to remember, she's an Irish woman, so she's tough, but she doesn't really wear a heart on her sleeve, by all means. She would, you know, let us in and be like, oh, I just feel incredibly, incredibly terrible that I can't give you more of what you want in life, like to be able to drive a car. But I got my driver's license at 25 and other things. But that's okay. I guess that's what parents do. They're always trying to provide for their children. So for a woman who's had so much difficulty, and the older you get, the more accustomed you get to your life, having a broken hip and a lot of several health issues, that she has maintained her dignity. She's been the head of the New Jersey chapter for American Foundation for Suicide Prevention for about 20 years now, after the death of my brother by suicide. She is just an incredible, courageous woman who is a tireless effort for the community, people touched by loss, you name it, she's always there. And for a woman who kind of was to be rocked by change, moving from one facility to the next, where she has her own apartment, which is, it's very nice. We got her very situated. I mean, she's got like a New York City apartment. It is swank. It's beautiful. But the reality is, it's change. But it proved to me in a month's time, she's only been there for about a month, that you are never, never too old to undergo and experience change and to embrace it. And she has, and she's doing, I'd say, very, very well at it. About once a week, she goes, oh, I don't know why I moved. I wish I didn't move. But that's normal. But she's socializing like crazy. And the takeaway here is that, you know, when it is December, and I'm not a big flip the calendar, let's start a new thing kind of guy. I'm like, every day is new opportunity. Not to be corny or anything, but really is. Why do you need a calendar to tell you that? Okay, January 1st, I'm not going to eat Chunky Monkey Ben and Jerry's every night in front of the TV. Or I'm going to lose weight. Or I'm going to finally start looking for a new job. Or I'm finally going to get out of this miserable relationship. Or I'm finally going to tell my parents that I'm gay. Or I'm finally going to whatever, fill in the blank. But that's the reality. A lot of people do. So my point, and for you, is that to understand, especially with our guest coming in a few minutes, Michael Dermer, about being an entrepreneur, if that's something you've ever considered, a new job, whether it's even something that's completely, completely not even related to what you're doing professionally right now, but you want to start it on the side, whether it's a small business. But the reality is, if you have the will and the desire, you certainly have the tools at your disposal, because with the internet, you can research everything. And the best thing about this, about being an entrepreneur, is that people love to talk about what they've done in their life, like their successes, their failures, et cetera. And certainly, I remember, you know, I tell people when they say, oh, you know, my son or daughter is going into communications, they want to be on radio, or this person's been on this radio station for a while and they want to try to get into the FM, can they call you? I say, sure, I'd love to help people out and talk to them. So if that's one of the things, is always to reach out to people in your professional industry and just say, hey, listen, this is what I'm thinking of doing, making a new foray into the field of X, Y, or Z, and pick people's brains. Hey, I want to buy you lunch, et cetera. So keep change in mind. Change is always good. Like every 7 years, what is that, like the physical aspect we kind of undergo, whether it's conscious or not, our bodies every 7 years? But it's good because it really kind of keeps you feeling alive and inspired, that's for sure. So Google Maps, this is very, very cool, has unveiled something new. For people with disabilities, you know, I talk about a lot of people with disabilities and aspects of life and profession for people in chairs and challenges, as we all have them. As I say, we all have some form of disability. Google Maps has unveiled a location wheelchair accessible way to determine if you can access it with a wheelchair. So very, very cool. And made me think about a lot of other things that Google could do to find out whether you want to go to a place or not go to a place. And if we have time at the end of the show, this is more of a wink, wink list that I created. We're going to talk about that. But one more thing I want to get to before we meet Michael. The other day, you heard about the very, very tragic shooting in Berlin. And it was kind of haunting, of course, and scary on many, many levels. But the reality of what I want to speak about is how we glorified it here in the United States. And this is a topic that is totally pointed at the media, which, and you know where I'm going with this. It's nothing new. But when I saw the cover of the Daily News and I saw the shooter after he shot the Russian representative for Turkey. Did I get that right? I think I may have gotten that slightly right. Slightly right. Anyway, the gunman standing there, gun in the air, well-dressed. The victim is laying flat. And it actually looks like a still from a movie set. Because the guy is so impeccably dressed and he's, I mean, the shot is incredible. Security footage was, you know, spot on. And I just, you know, that, why do we have to put that on a cover of a major, major newspaper? The Daily News. All right. So yes, Daily News, I get it. New York Post. Yep. Sure. Sensationalism at its best. New York Times did the same thing. Now, is the New York Times a more of a bourgeois paper? Do they typically have more ethical responsibilities or consider themselves a little bit more conservative in that regard? I think so, but they didn't. On Tuesday, was this? Tuesday, I believe. And it really just kind of, I just stood there looking at the magazine or the newspaper rack in Penn Station. And I was just in kind of disbelief because this is what we're doing. We're just, you know, the cyclical motion of perpetuating the violence of the world that we live in. Of course, it could be the headlines, but the cover of the newspaper does not have to be the picture of this person. Because do they win? I mean, I don't know. It's just talk and words. But the reality is, I just don't think it's proper professional media coverage. Talk about the bigger issue, the security risk, the fallout of this, what could happen. And if you're going to put the picture, include the picture, don't put it on a cover. You know, I know you're in the business of selling papers, and we all know this, that the world of journalism, except if you're covering the president-elect, is suffering. And New Jersey as well as Chris Christie. I don't know if you're following this Chris Christie story. Governor of New Jersey is trying to do away with certain papers, and it's actually very interesting. I'm going off topic here, but if you're interested in learning more about that, just Google Chris Christie and newspapers and what he's trying to do, because it's kind of appalling. He's just trying to get back at people for being the resentful person and angry man that he is. Anyway, so I just wanted to say that I don't know if you felt that way as well. But I was just kind of very perplexed and taken aback by, the actions of, and I understand where they are coming from. It's a business model, but you can do it with a little bit more dignity and grace. And I hope so, man. So the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame 2017 nominees were announced, and we got some great names in here. Yes. Yes is a great band. Love them growing up. Journey, of course. How can you not like Journey? Finally, Electric Light Orchestra. I know they were up for a long time. Joan Baez. Any Joan Baez fans out there? Ah, yeah, of course, of course. Tupac, you know, a lot of people on Facebook were like, oh, why, it's the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but he's certainly not by any means the first rapper or person from the hip-hop industry. And it's not so much confined to rock and roll. Obviously, the pool of nominees has been widened a great deal for many, many years now. And it's just about their contribution to music, the concentric circles, the influences, and how they have shaped generations of musicians to come. Because, you know, rock and rollers certainly talk about how, you know, sometimes different formats of music, whether it's country, hip hop, even. Sometimes there's obviously collaborations like crazy nowadays. Sometimes they collaborate too much in my eyes. But it's great to see. It's going to be happening in April 2017. But the biggest band that I'm really, really happy to see, Eddie Vedder, Pearl Jam, finally getting nominated. A band that's certainly, you know, proven themselves time and time again. He's a great musician, obviously activist, well-spoken, and does a lot of great things off the stage as well. And I'm very happy to see that. And thank you so much for listening this and every Thursday to Progressive Radio Network. Insight's going to return in just a moment, and you're going to meet author, speaker, entrepreneur, and more, Mike Dermer. And here's Pearl Jam. It's Inside on a Progressive Radio Network. My name is Mark Farrell. Thank you for joining me for this Thursday show, 21 minutes after the hour, 11 o'clock in New York City. Michael Dermer is my guest. Michael Dermer is an entrepreneur, speaker, lawyer. Whew, man, a lot. And are you a Pearl Jam fan?
I am a Pearl Jam fan.
Good. All right. And a pioneer to the movement, reward employees for healthy behavior. And just a few years ago, out of law school, Michael left a coveted job as a corporate lawyer to pursue the dream of being his own boss, with a bold idea of rewarding Americans for healthy behavior and in the progress saving the healthcare system a bundle. Dermer started
Incent One.
Thank you, Incent One. I can't read my writing. For 10 years, he worked to motivate a team, convince the healthcare industry, which is a lofty task, win customers and get buy-in from skeptics. Finally, on October 15, 2008, after landing plum customers like Deloitte and General Motors, Dermer clinched a private equity investment that should have put Incent One on the path to billion-dollar riches. But we know what happened after that.
Yep.
So it's all about reinvention, huh, Mike?
All the time, just as you were talking to your audience about before.
What do you attribute yourself, the number one reason why you left the corporate atmosphere as a lawyer? I guess you're an in-house attorney.
Yep.
Which is typically a very coveted job. I mean, it's I can't say a cushy job because you have to work your tail off. Yep. And everyone's looking at you like, what do we do, Michael? Yep. You know, in this situation, we're getting sued. Yep. How do we position ourselves for X, Y, and Z? But, you know, it's a job that where most people stay for many, many years. Yep. And which I'm sure you could have ridden your whole career out on. Mm-hmm. But you decided to become an entrepreneur. Why is this?
Well, yeah, I worked for one of the most prestigious law firms in New York City, and I just got the idea. You know, it's almost like when the idea came across your desk, as you mentioned before, it was, you know, rewarding people for healthy behavior. It almost becomes like oxygen. It kind of just sees through your veins, right? It's not even optional anymore. And so once that idea got in my head, don't get me wrong, I was a business guy and had always thought about starting my own business, so I had some of that in me. But to me, this idea had so many things that checked boxes for me. I could help society, create a great business, make people healthier. And from that point, it was, you know, the beginning of the end, as they say.
Define healthy living as you're applying it here.
Yeah, so everything from, you know, not eating donuts to going to the gym to getting a mammogram, you know, all the things that we know in the medical profession saves money, right? So think about just getting women to get breast cancer screenings when they're 40, right? So all of those different behaviors, our idea was just like you reward people for buying shoes and staying in hotels and going on airlines, why you reward
sure.
them for getting a mammogram or going to the gym.
And your definition of entrepreneur, because it's critical for listeners and myself to understand your perception here and how they're integral and part and parcel.
Yeah, it's interesting. Entrepreneur, I think, used to mean you're going to go leave and start a business and take risks. Now it's actually a mindset. You know, I have people all over the place. You were talking before about change, right? Just the idea of being entrepreneurial, thinking about things a different way, and maybe taking the risk that goes with that. Certainly in the more traditional sense, it's okay, it's what entrepreneur means in French. It's to take a risk and take responsibility. But I think now as people think about that, not just the mindset, but, you know, what does it actually mean to go and be an entrepreneur in today's society?
Now, I think when most people hear the word entrepreneur, they think about someone just hanging a shingle and starting their own solo business, which is fine, which is great, because what is the definition, actually, I'm getting sidetracked here, of a small business in America? Is it below 50 employees or?
Yeah, if you look at the numbers, 95% of the business in America are below 50 employees.
And they make up the bulk of the business.
Absolutely. And the number of businesses that actually get to 50 employees is something like 4%.
Really?
Yeah. So we fail to realize, especially living where we live on the East Coast, that most of the businesses out there are a couple of people at the most, and sometimes a lot of solo folks, you know, being entrepreneurs. We always hear about Google and Facebook and right, all these great inventions that turn into billion-dollar companies. But the lion's share of folks out there are trying to figure out if they can build their idea into a couple people that can sustain itself.
And that's why, I guess, imagine a lot of small business entrepreneurs are holding their breath to see what happens on January 20th.
Absolutely.
In the ensuing years.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully, both candidates talk a lot about small business and enabling small business. I think, you know, with President-elect Trump, I think you hope that the business climate will be such that people wake up every day going, small business people are the lifeblood of America. So how do we figure out ways to make it easy for them, get more access to capital, you know, help them overcome the typical challenges of being an entrepreneur?
So obviously, you're not a slacker. You went to college, you went to law school, you passed the bar. So it's obviously in your blood to be a hard worker. Now, what would you say to people? Because being an entrepreneur incorporates so many different things. Obviously, a hard worker and someone who has a tireless and passion for what they do is critical. What are some other must-haves for people who are even dabbling on the edge of being an entrepreneur?
Well, certainly you have to have some foundational things. You got to be comfortable being uncomfortable. Like you said, you've got to be able to work hard. You've got to be able to stick to a path, you know, in the face of resistance. But I think we've done a little bit of a disservice to entrepreneurs and said, you know, as long as you have passion and grit, you're fine. As opposed to saying, you know, think about the first time you sat in front of that microphone. Were you great at it? But you just said, hey, I'm pretty good and I've got something to build on, but I'm going to get better at it. I'm going to understand. And that's what I don't think we've done enough with entrepreneurs. We said, here's enough to get on the ride, but passion and grit and some of those other things aren't enough. It's how do I become better at communicating my message? How do I learn enough about finances? How do I learn the things I'm not good at? So I need to find other people. You know, no different than a golfer says, I have to work on my short game, right? They don't show up as a great golfer. They have to work on it. And I think there's some foundational things, but I also think we have to do a better job of challenging entrepreneurs and giving them the tools to actually get better at it.
You touched on one of the first things you said. I want to go back to getting comfortable about being uncomfortable. Yeah. Expand upon that, please.
Well, just think about the definition of it. You're going to do something that in your own mind is different, right?
Friends of yours. Uncharted territory.
You're going to, you know,
financial risk, security, safety, everything.
Right. Nobody says, I'm going to go start an entrepreneurial venture to do something what everybody else is doing. So even if it's in your own mind, what you believe you're doing is unique. And what comes with that is the uncertainty. It's the uncertainty, are your customers going to buy it? Is the market going to like it? And you'll have a lot of friends and family and relationships that aren't comfortable being uncomfortable. So even the idea of doing something that doesn't already have a path that's plotted becomes really uncomfortable for them. So that's just, I mean, you said it before, we're asking entrepreneurs to digest so much. There's very few things in life that implicate your financial life, your personal life, your emotional life, your business life. And oh, by the way, you got to figure it out on the fly. And that's a pretty overwhelming experience.
And it's essentially 24/7, 365.
Yeah.
No matter whether you're an entrepreneur or not, because I kind of couch it as, you know, we all, whether you work for a corporation or not, you're pretty much an entrepreneur because you're never off the clock.
Yeah. You have to be these days, but I used to say the next great business was to create the 25-hour day, right? Because entrepreneurs, it is 24/7, 365. In fact, there's a chapter in the book where we say, I hate Christmas in August. Because entrepreneurs this time of year go, how is it that everybody could take time off? And how can people go to the beach, go down the Jersey Shore in the summer on August? How does France take 2 months off? Because it freaks us out because we're like, it's the end of the year. I got to get stuff done. No one's around. So there's no question that the being a better entrepreneur is acknowledging that is the nature of the beast, but then what do you do about it? How do you manage that? How do you make it more productive for yourself as opposed to just being overwhelmed?
And hence the name of your book, The Lonely Entrepreneur.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that all the things that I've been talking about, you put all that in the pot and stir it together. The ability to not say, okay, this is how I feel, great, but what do I actually do about it? What do I do? What's the best thing to do in this 5-day period, 10-day period where there's time off and nobody's working, right? Well, we just did something yesterday. We said, listen, you're going to freak out if you take the whole time off. But you do need some time to let your brain relax and your body.
And you need distance, yes.
And you're just so take a day and don't do any work. But the next day, go do 3 or 4 hours of work, right? And when you're there with your family, be there, right? Don't have if your mind's thinking about your business, go back to your desk. Don't spend time with your family. So it's just the way. This is just one of many things, as you can imagine. It's just the way that you take that overwhelming feeling and what you do with it. No different than a golfer standing over a 60-yard shot goes, "How do I deal with the pressure?" Well, I practiced, I got better, and I know the wind's going to do this and the green's going to do that. So how do we help them get better at it?
So tell me about your model in terms of when you were a lawyer working at a big corporation and trying to determine whether this was a great model to start on your own, and how big did you start?
Yeah. If you think about the idea, it just made sense, right? We know we save money as a system if more women get mammograms when they're 40. And we know this whole group of women are not, right? We know diabetics are eating pizza. We know, right, keep going down the list. So you knew there was a certain amount of money you could reward them with, right, that would make them do it and would make economic sense. And reward programs had been used in lots of other industries. What I really tried to do is I went to people that weren't necessarily just my friends or people that cared about me who would maybe tell me what I wanted to hear and not be candid with me. I happen to have a lot of, you know, legal and finance people that I knew that were really smart, that were objective. And they were like, wow, this could really, if you could operationalize this, you could really turn it into something. So for me, and again, this is one of those skills, for people with ideas, we always believe that our meatballs are the best meatballs, right? Even though there's plenty of meatball shops here. Think about Starbucks. There was no lack of coffee in New York City when Starbucks launched, right? And so it's the idea, like going to
it's
third
the environment, parts. It's the whole presentation, it's how you dress it.
Yeah. And so for me, one of those techniques about being a better entrepreneur is how do you go to friends and colleagues and others who will be objective for you to say, hey, this is a really good idea. Or as you just said, it's a good idea if you did 1, 2, 3 a little bit differently.
Fascinating. What's your elevator pitch if you had one for this? Do you have one for this?
Sure, yeah. Sure.
For your model back then.
Oh, for back then.
Yes.
We used to kid around and say it's American Express rewards for mammograms, right? And we used to say, listen, you reward people for flying on a plane, right? You reward people for buying shoes. Why wouldn't you reward them for being healthy? And don't get me wrong. I say it now facetiously. It took us the better part of a decade to convince the healthcare industry that they would reward people because that was almost offensive to them. But it was just the idea that was so compelling.
Were you targeting mostly women or were you doing the same for men as well?
Believe it or not.
Testicular exams.
Yeah. Believe it or not, men are even more unhealthy than women. So.
Well, yeah, I can see that. We're more in denial. We're more like, oh, we're fine.
Right.
We're never. Unless it has us bent over and, you know, crippled in pain.
Yeah. So, I mean, even take something simple like somebody who has asthma, right? Moms will rush their kids to the emergency room 4 times a year at a cost of $15,000 where they could buy a $100 inhaler. There were so many things. Like we're talking about, you know, eating pizza. There were so many things that the medical profession knew what they wanted to get people to do that they just couldn't get them to do.
So looking back, what were the three or four things that you did right and 3 or 4 things that you didn't do so well?
Yeah. I think the one thing we really did right was we really painted the vision for everybody we interacted with. We really said to employees, to investors, to customers, this is where we're going, and we were very steadfast. So even, and we'll get to it, the challenges of 2008, even during that crazy time, people believed in what we were doing, and that's an incredibly powerful thing. You know, think about a jet fan, right? A jet fan is just, you got to believe.
Resilient.
Right? Yeah, you got to believe. Right?
If you don't believe.
Still have to believe.
Right, you would have jumped off a long time ago. That was something we did right. I would say a couple of things that I did wrong in particular was, I did not understand how important it was to spend a little extra money and hire the right people. There were so many times where, whether it was a CFO or a salesperson, whatever it may be, that I said, I don't think the extra $25,000 is worth it. And not just money, but just, you know, remember, I came from, I was a college athlete. I was a corporate lawyer at a prestigious New York law firm. Where I went to law school, Northwestern, was the worst law school that my law firm accounting from. It was like number 7 in the country. So I wasn't used to this whole idea of people had to be motivated.
Best,
you were just always around the best. And I made mistakes about not really understanding the value of people. If you have money and people and the right people, you can do a ton. And I was just not wired that way. And over, I used to say things like, I'll never have an HR department. It's just a cost. And now I'm the complete opposite, is if you can really get the right people and empower them, your business can do amazing.
I would imagine that's the hub of your business.
Yeah. I mean, there's some
culturally, functionally.
Yeah. And you know what? It's so counterintuitive for entrepreneurs because though I can't worry about how everybody's feeling. You all just got to, you know, work your butts off.
Exactly.
And we'll figure it out. It's those places that kind of do the opposite, that really empower those people, that unlock them in that environment and understand how important that is, that really can unlock a value, because that person can grow and learn and become bigger and not be treated as, you know, for example, as just a functional employee. And that's something I think I got wrong in the early days.
Yeah, nobody wants to feel like they're just a cog in a wheel.
Absolutely.
So when you started out, how many employees did you have?
It was just me. I went from, you know, prestigious New York corporate law firm to a basement. And then a guy that I knew from Bucknell, where I went to college, I ran into randomly in a gym in Hoboken, New Jersey. And I said, what are you doing? And he said, it was the early days of, I'm working on this thing called the internet. And I was like, you know, listen, we've got this idea. Do you mind working on it? We used to literally go to the gym and work out. And afterwards, just business plan. And so at first it was just me and him. And then, you know, we had started to grow and get some customers. But we were still fighting the healthcare industry a lot. So it was very incremental growth. And we grew relatively quickly. But we were, you know, always trying to fight this big behemoth and trying to get them to, I mean, think about it. What we're doing is almost offensive, right? We're going to pay people who are doing the worst. So for a long, long time, they fought us on it. So our growth of employees was 1 and 2 and 5 and just the normal incremental growth.
But I imagine back then you were able to predict and or provide graphs and charts and forecasts of money saved. Why wouldn't you gain their attention? Because it's not tried and true?
You know, 1 out of every $6 in America is spent on healthcare, and it's really screwed up. We should be able to do better with the money that we have. It's just the nature of the beast. It's really slow moving. It's really entrenched in what it does. And it's so complicated that simple, like if you had the cure to cancer tomorrow, it would still take 5 years for it to be covered on your health plan.
Speaking of that, did you read about the 21st century cure bill that was passed?
No.
I think there is $18 billion or so earmarked for NIH, National Institute for Health, for 10 years for cancer.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But when you really think about it, $18 billion sounds like a lot. It's not really that much.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, so that's the thing. The healthcare industry, there's so many hands in the pot. Mm. There's the health plans and pharmaceutical companies and the government, that common sense solutions don't always make sense. And that's something that we mistimed. Because I said exactly what you said, which, yeah, it'll take a little time, but pregnant women, for every 10 pregnant women that don't follow their prenatal care, it costs the healthcare system $1 million. So why wouldn't you give those 10 women $10,000 and save the system $900,000?
Now, when you say give somebody $10,000, in what form and how would it be dispensed?
It was really like your points program. So no different when you swipe your credit card and earn points, when you got those points. But those points were good for money. They were good for either cash, money off your insurance premium, money into a health savings account, gift cards, debit cards, you know, anything cash and cash equivalent. So it was real stuff. You do this, you get that, and everybody should win. But it took a long time.
And how long did it take before you realized you turned a corner and realized that this could possibly work?
From the day that we thought of the idea, really in 1998, it probably took almost a decade. You know, we had started to break through a lot in, 06, 07, and really had broken through up to the time that you mentioned that we got our private equity investment and then almost watched our business get destroyed by the financial crisis. So, but it took the better part of a decade.
So you really believe, because, I mean, that's a lot of years to put in for something. I guess you were making money enough to obviously stay afloat and, you know, have a decent life. But, you know, that's a lot of time to be chasing the carrot.
Yeah, and we weren't really making money. I mean, as much as you're progressing, as any entrepreneur knows,
you're throwing it right back in it,
and you've got obligations, and you've never got so it was a real slog during that time. But we really believed, and we were getting early indications from customers along the way. But it still takes a really long time for those folks to move. Had I done it a little bit differently, I would have timed it a little different. I would have got more capital earlier because it was going to take longer than we expected to do it. But we, at some point, we just had to get over the fact that it makes sense doesn't exactly turn it into a business that generates cash flow.
So when did Incent One, obviously the 08 crash happened. Did you think that was it? Time's over, a decade done, waste of time?
You know, we had, at that point, it was the time to celebrate. And we had done it for 10 years. We had huge customers. We had just taken a private equity investment, you know, basically 10 years. And it almost got destroyed in 10 days. If you read the Wall Street Journal, our biggest customers, the companies that don't exist right now, Washington Mutual, Countrywide Financial, at the time, General Motors, these were our biggest customers, were just gone. I was never a guy that said, it's just over. That's not in my DNA. But I also felt a great responsibility to my family that had put money into it, the couple hundred employees we had at the time.
Couple hundred, wow.
Yeah, our investors that had given us money. And so you just kind of show up every day and take the lumps. But it was a wild 20-hour days. I mean, it was just to save what had taken us 10 years to build. It was a wild
time.
So
at that point, did you go in panic mode in terms of trying to retweak your product, in terms of maybe earmarking additional money? What outlets, what industries could you tap into? I mean, I guess your mind was just constantly going.
What's so interesting about it is that all the normal solutions weren't going to work. Mm. I mean, if you remember that time, it was just complete chaos. And so for me, like every entrepreneur, not just me, but you can't have panic because every day there's stuff that goes wrong. And at that time, obviously, that was happening in spades. You know, my focus was just go in and chip away. The best analogy I had was if you ever watched the movie Apollo 13 with Tom Hanks, when they don't know if the spaceship's going to make it back in and they've got all this stuff that needs to go right. And one of the co-pilots says to him, what happens if this happens, this happens, this happens? And Tom Hanks says, listen, we have 113 things we need to go right. We're on number 7. Work the problem. And that was my mindset. I couldn't, if you even opened your eyes and read the paper that day, a company like ours would have no chance of survival. And so we just basically said, let's work it. And then you had to bring your best thought and creativity in an incredibly, you know, chaotic environment. So it was pretty wild.
How much time did it take you to recover?
Took us about a year and a half. Things started to stabilize a little bit. And then we were very fortunate because a couple of years later, we ended up successfully selling it. And it worked out great. But it was, I would lie to you if I said I went, you know, today when you go to work and it's today, it's Friday, you didn't feel like the week accumulated. You're like, yeah, it's the end of the week. I could use the weekend. Back then by Friday, your hair was messed up. You needed a drink. I mean, you had gotten kicked between the legs, not once a day, but 100 times a day. So now I look back on it and, you know, you were talking about your mom. Other than parents dying and getting sick, I can't imagine what would be hard compared to that time, because I can't even go back to it mentally because it was such a crazy, chaotic time. But coming out of it was an incredibly rewarding experience for everybody who was involved.
At what point did you decide to sell? I know what the point was, but what was it? Was it the fact that your company was at its pinnacle?
Yeah, what happened was when the country came out of the crisis, there was this huge healthcare number that was overwhelming the economy because nobody even thought about it for a couple of years because of the financial crisis. So this whole idea of, wow, what are we going to do with all these people that are unhealthy, and nobody had done anything. So our concept had resonated. And listen, people always say, you know, the day before you sell your business, you're an idiot. The day after, you're brilliant. People say now, wow, you guys were ahead of your time. At that point, people had really gotten used to the idea that, listen, if we don't reward people, we've seen it now for 6, 7, 8 years. They're just not doing what need to be done. So you could feel the wave, right, of momentum around what we had done, and we had been the first. And so because we had been the first, it just made sense to do something.
Mike Dermer is my guest. He has written The Lonely Entrepreneur. My name is Mark Farrell. The show is Insight on the Progressive Radio Network. Talk about more of the, because obviously this is a great entrepreneurial insight onto a company that was obviously, what was your net when you were doing well?
Probably 60 million.
60 million. Let's bring it down to like maybe 59 million or 59.5 million.
Yep, yep.
to people who, you know, have the same drive, the same passion, the same wherewithal and commitment, but, you know, are working with maybe solo or maybe a staff of 2 or 3 people in terms of leadership, morale, customer interaction. And you point out something very interesting, that not just one person within a company should have relationship with the client because you just don't want to give that one perception or one, help me out here.
It's one face of the business. Yeah. Well, I think that even though we had grown pretty big and we started as one, but listen, I had a pretty good advantage. I was a finance guy. I was an M&A lawyer. So I had some foundation. Mm. Here's what I would say.
Great background.
Yeah, I had a pretty good foundation to start a business. If you're something that doesn't have that foundation, you have to embrace that being an entrepreneur is not a job, it's an identity. And if it is your identity, then you embrace the things that you need to know, right? You don't say, I know everything I need to know. You basically say, great, I want to be an entrepreneur, I have an idea. What does that mean? Okay, what do I have to do? Well, I need to know enough about money. Like I need to understand a little bit about finances, how to do that. If I don't know that or I hate that, great. Maybe I can get an advisor that can help me. Okay, great. I'm really good at a product or service. Like, that's really my strong point. Great. Well, maybe I don't know that much about marketing, right? So how do I get enough of a foundation? How do I validate my idea? You know, so what do you do? Let's bring in some people that don't know me that well, that will take a look at it. So it's about developing these techniques. It's not I have passion and grit, and if I run into that wall 100 times, it should stop hurting. It's I have passion and grit and maybe a vision. Awesome. But okay, what are the pieces that I have to get better at? In fact, that's the whole mission behind what we're trying to do with The Lonely Entrepreneur, is to give people all these tools and techniques to get incrementally better at. So you go, okay, now I know what it means to put forth a cash flow statement. Now I know what it means to actually use social media to market my business or whatever it may be.
What about the lack of funds in terms of the sage advice you just gave in terms of bringing person X, Y, and Z on, whether it's a contract or whatever, just to get their professional insight? Are there any ways to tap into existing professionals, retired professionals? Because there are, I'm sure, a boatload of people out there who, and one of the things I have a problem with in our society is that there are so many incredible former CEOs, top executives that have time and the resources and desire to contribute inside of that nature?
Tons, right? So your friends and your network will definitely help. If you say, I'm going to start a business, there's definitely people that have insights that will do it for you gratis, right? Next is your university, right? Tons and tons of resources, tons and tons of kids at NYU right now that would love to think about a business plan for a new business that are getting entrepreneurial experience, okay? In addition to that, they have small business development centers all throughout the country. And they have this thing called SCORE, which is all these retired executives that for free will help you do business plans. And so there's all kinds of free resources. And then even when you have to go pay for something, there's ways to be creative, right? So for example, you can get freelancers. Right now, you could literally say, I want to get a logo. And you can put it on a platform that people throughout the world bid on it. And there'll be somebody in India that will do it for $2, where somebody here would do it for $200. So there's lots and lots of things where you can be creative with freelancers, both here in the US as well as, you know, as well as things throughout the world. So this goes back to working on your short game, right? This goes back to think about what we've said. There's all these different things that you can get better at this. So imagine the next day you went and said, I didn't need money for social media. But that's because I was basing it on hiring somebody for $70,000 a year to be my social media manager. Why couldn't I hire somebody part-time here in the U.S. or maybe even hire somebody overseas that could be on social media for you? So it's really a matter of taking advantage of all those free resources you mentioned, but also knowing the different things that you can do that are not that expensive but can be effective.
Of course, it's easy to give advice about riding the high wave. What about the lows? Because I find with my business that sometimes, you know, a lot of my time is spent – my business is mostly word of mouth. Mm-hmm. You got to have Mark Farrell in. He was a great speaker. He just, you know, had the audience just incredibly energized, and his messages were being reverberated around the halls, whatever, for months, whatever. And that's great. But there's only a certain amount of, I guess, clientele that can spread to in terms of concentric circles within one industry, et cetera, because, you know, people have their jobs and their normal lives to get back to, so they can't be the ombudsman for Mark Farrell.
Yep.
So when you make all these phone calls, and maybe out of 100, if I'm doing cold calls, you get maybe 3 leads or 4 leads, and it gets depressing.
Yeah.
And, you know, your energy gets drained. And sometimes, you know what I do? Gym is one thing. Yeah. I walk away from it, as you said. You know, you got to get away from it. Sometimes I go to a movie that I know is going to be a feel-good movie, and it pumps me back up.
Yeah.
And also, you got to realize the importance of that phone call and the slight lead. You know, I always say to my wife, like, I got a few people on the hook. I got Princeton University. I got UMass or whatever. Yeah. And those things. And sometimes they don't pan out for whatever reason. Yeah. Timing, money, et cetera. Yeah. But they are the things that really, really catapult me to keep going.
Yep. So I think there's two parts of it, right? There's the functional part of how do you get better, in your case, of customer acquisition. And while we lack capital and resources, what we don't lack is the ability to be creative. So if you and I got off the radio and we sat here for 2 hours and we'd say, okay, you're calling these people, but why are we calling these people? Are we calling them at the right time of day? Is there a different audience? You know, how do you do it differently? So there's the functional part of it. And that's where like a board of advisors can be great. They could be like, listen, you're really talented. You've got presence, but why would we do it there? Why would, you know, do you take the same red dress? If you take a red dress and you go to Bloomingdale's, Bloomingdale's will say, we got plenty of red dresses. If you take that same red dress and you said, what if we made it part of a personal shopping experience for every new lawyer in New York City with the same red dress? So part of it is functionally how you do it. But the other part is kind of the visceral emotional part. You know, what happens when you're in the middle of it, when it's not working? And when you're an entrepreneur, a lot of stuff doesn't work, right? You're doing something new. It by definition isn't going to work. You know, here's what I would say. Number one is pick a plan and stick to it, right? Because by definition, you're doing something new. So every direction you go in, you're going to find obstacles. If you wildly swing from this type of customer to this type of customer, you're going to see obstacles in all of them. You got to pick a plan, because then what happens is you get better at it, right? You talked about Freehold, New Jersey and commuting into the city. If you go the same way every day, you know when the traffic hits you, right? You know when the weather hits you. If you went a different way every day, you'd be figuring it out every single time. The other part is, we call it in the book, don't evaluate your life in the middle of the fight. So think about a boxing match, right? They take the winner, the guy who won, and they ask him at the end of the match, you know, are you going to retire? And he says, of course I'm going to retire. I just got hit in the face for 2 hours. But then 2 weeks later, he chills out and realizes, you know, it's great to be champ and all that stuff. What entrepreneurs do is when something goes wrong or it's not working, that's when we decide to evaluate if we should be an entrepreneur. You have to do that. Do it on the weekends. Do it when, you know, you're chilling out. Don't do it on a Tuesday afternoon after your 30th cold call where nobody called you back. So it's part how you do it, but it's part understanding that you've got to get comfortable with some of this uncomfortableness as long as you're always improving how you're going about it.
And talk about taking it personally, because I realized early on, certainly if you're a person who's been in the business world versus somebody who's just come out of college and wants to start a business, be an entrepreneur, I think they have a real challenge there, because you have to have a business acumen to some degree. You don't maybe have to have a financial background, et cetera, but you have to understand the functionality, the reality of how people work, and whether it's just because it's a political environment, et cetera, or they just feel like you haven't earned your way in life. But to not take it personally, to understand it's either, or if it is personal, to realize, well, that's that person. It's not me. It's not my product. Then I'm just going to either readdress that issue or just redress and couch and position myself for client X, Y, and Z.
Well, it goes back to the nature of the beast of being an entrepreneur. It's not that you should take it personally. It's that it's natural to take it personally. It's what do you do about it? It's knowing that about yourself.
Reaction to it.
It's reaction to it. So it absolutely is personal, right? I'm the only one there that's there at 3 a.m.
Sure.
But if an investor comes into you and says, I don't really think that your pricing model is the right pricing model, right? Or I don't really think your flowers are going to sell, right? There's two ways to look at that. One is I'm getting valuable feedback that makes my business better. The other is like a mailman coming into your house and saying, how dare you feed your daughter that way? I mean, it's not that it isn't personal. It's about, okay, understanding that it is personal for you. How is it you're supposed to receive it when somebody is critical of what you're doing or doesn't believe in what you're doing? I mean, think about that. If somebody asked you now, give me your opinion on my business, right? And you gave them your opinion, you're trying to help. You're trying to make it better. If that person doesn't embrace that, it's their own reality. And so we as entrepreneurs have to recognize, understandably, that we're under this pressure and this is passion for us and we really believe in it. But then, to your point, how do we react in it to it, and how do we actually make that a productive part of
it? And I imagine extrapolate any validity they may have.
Of course.
It's
absolutely
huge.
Absolutely. And think about how, I mean, we're blinded. right? We're blinded
yeah,
by
we're too
our
close
passion.
To it, sure.
We're too close to it. So when a third party comes in, like an advisor, and gives you advice to say, here's how it might not work, here's how you could do it differently, you know, us going back to our desk and pouting and banging a head against the wall as opposed to actually taking the best from that is, you know, that's just our own fault.
Or shooting yourself in the foot and possibly sending out an email that should not have been sent out.
Yeah, totally.
Or a phone call. I remember early on getting a few phone calls that people had booked me and they called me up and whether they, you know, tried to half me in terms of yeah. the contractual money, et cetera. Yeah. I just remember just sometimes even putting my phone on mute.
Yeah.
And just saying a few things loud and then coming back and be like, oh, you know, I totally understand your predicament. I'm happy to work with you in whatever way I can because I figured, okay, I could lose this client forever or just lose them for a year.
Yeah.
Because next year is a new budget, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm like, hey, listen, that's great. You know, when can I call you? Another 6 months. Great. We'll reevaluate and happy to work with next year's budget because, you know, you have a hot lead right there.
Yeah.
Don't blow it because maybe they were unprofessional or, you know, for whatever reason, because your name is still your name.
And you have to be able to fundamentally believe that if you empower employees and customers, investors, you win. That's really hard when you can't pay the bills.
Not only that, but also it makes them realize what an utmost professional you
absolutely.
Are.
Absolutely. So think about that's an example of being a better entrepreneur. You're in the middle of it. You thought someone's gonna cut you a check. They backed off and you could take different paths. You could have reacted to your own personal feelings about it, or you could have said, hey, if I help them be successful down the line, everybody wins. To your point about emails, we have something in the book called Seven Deadly Sins. And one of those deadly sins is we say never write an email after 10 o'clock at night because that's a lot of terrible things happen after 10 o'clock at night. Think about an entrepreneur, right? Working all day, might be frustrated. It's the end of the day. If you know, you happen to put the phone on mute. If you knew the number of times where you're about to send that email and you read it the next day and you're like, oh, my God, they would take you to jail.
Cringing.
Right, exactly. So if you think about all the stuff we're talking about, Mark, we're talking about being a better entrepreneur. Like all of the topics we've covered are just how do you react to these situations and get better at it? Because when you get better at it, then you go back to your desk and that person that a year ago you had the same conversation with, and when they come back, you had a sales success. This is not just ethereal, right? It's all these things you mentioned. You had a success that, oh, and I got more money because I got better as an entrepreneur.
And it proves that your tenacity to obviously work as a professional, et cetera, and you're still there. And it almost feels like you have the upper hand as well.
Yeah.
Now, you just mentioned something interesting about the actual content and tonality of emails, of writing them or not. This could be minor, but I think sometimes it's major because I do a lot of my work sometimes at night because if I'm at a speaking gig during the day and I got to get some invoices out at night or whatever. What is your perception on sending, not pitches, pitches or any type of emails anywhere from 11 o'clock at night to 5 in the morning?
Yep.
Does that not look good to clients?
I think here's what I would say. It definitely doesn't look good to employees. So employees need their space, especially people that are working their butts off. So sending them things at 2 o'clock in the morning means you don't respect their space. I do think, though, and a technique you used to use all the time, we happen to do it through phone calls, but emails is the same, is when people start their day, right, they're fresh. Think about when you come in, right? So we used to leave voicemails at 7 in the morning to somebody we wanted to really respond
to. What's
a
voicemail?
Just, right, exactly. Back in the day, old school. Here's what I would say. When you have to add value in whatever communication that you're putting forth, if you add value, the customer will appreciate it. If you don't, they won't, right? That means that it's not about what you're selling, right? It's not about what you're offering. It's about what you help them accomplish. And if you help them accomplish that and you do it shortly and succinctly, they will welcome the communication.
So the timing's irrelevant.
The timing's irrelevant as long as you add value.
Good, good. The Lonely Entrepreneur, who's publishing this?
We self-published it.
Oh, nice. Very good.
We did.
Fiscally responsible. And your website, Michael Dermer.
It's lonelyentrepreneur.com. And also for folks out there, we have free gifts for the holidays. So we have this thing, lonelyentrepreneur.com/free gift. Then anybody can get there, a whole bunch of free gifts. But
what kind of gifts? Last minute
perspectives and free advice and a whole bunch of stuff.
Awesome. And what is that name you mentioned before? SCORE? Is that an acronym for?
Yeah, it's the Society of Retired Executives, SCORE.
Michael Dermer, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
My name is Mark Farrell. Have a great holiday, whatever you're experiencing and are celebrating, Christmas, Kwanzaa, Hanukkah, you name it. We'll be back next Thursday. Any of my shows are available on prn.fm under Insight. Have a great day. Enjoy.